evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanzler in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, June 27, 2019. South Sudan denies the former petroleum minister is being blocked from leaving the country.
For the transparent sake, that the committee must be committee is formed to investigate whether still South Sudan owes any companies, the crude oil, or it is the Republic of South Sudan that is being owed.
And the SPLM-IO says their troops at the cantonment site in Amadi State have no food and shelter.
There's nothing. There's no medical facility, no food. Well, what is available there is only water because there is a river, Yei River Nile, passing through.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The government of South Sudan has denied reports that security operatives have prevented former Petroleum Minister Ambassador Ezekiel Lolgat-Kwot from leaving South Sudan after President Kiir ordered an investigation into oil contracts. Several reliable sources have confirmed to this program that Ambassador Gat-Kwot was blocked from leaving South Sudan on Tuesday. Wake Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
President Salva Kiir this week appointed a committee to investigate crude oil sales to determine the number of pre-sale agreements signed with the companies exploring crude oil in South Sudan's oil fields. Mr. Kiir issued a decree Tuesday ordering a committee headed by the Minister of Cabinet Affairs, Martin Elia Lomro, and the country's Auditor General to investigate dealings of the Ministry of Petroleum and report back in 2 weeks. Ambassador Gat-Kwot was fired on June 12 while on a personal trip to Nigeria. South Sudan in Focus placed several phone calls to Gat-Kwot for comment on this story, but he declined to answer the calls, nor did he respond to text messages. South Sudan presidential spokesman Atene Wek Atene says the 7-member committee will investigate oil-related correspondence and agreements signed by the Ministry of Petroleum and the Ministry of Finance.
The term of references is first to ascertain the number of pre-sales agreements, past and present, and the details of the companies allocated South Sudan crude oils on the basis of free sales. Also to investigate the free sale process, offtake sales, payments and taxes thereof. And the third is to engage the Auditor General to audit the free sales in order to reconcile payments and liabilities against the government of the Republic of South Sudan.
Atene says the president wants to know how the country's oil industry has performed since the country gained its independence up until the present time.
It is for the transparent sake that, the committee committee is formed to investigate whether still South Sudan owes any companies, the crude oil, or it is the Republic of South Sudan that is being owed by those other companies, because the oil has been free sold to a number of companies up to some months ahead of us. And so the president wanted to know exactly whether we are on the right track.
Nyaltit Mamir, a researcher and a policy analyst at the Juba-based Soot Institute, has published several reports on South Sudan's oil industry. He says South Sudan's oil industry has been marred by a lack of transparency for years, but adds that Kiir's decision to investigate the oil sector is a step in the right direction.
We don't even know, the public is not sure about the oil production data, for example, the volume. So we are told that the oil fields in Paloj, for example, are producing 130,000 barrels per day. But we are not sure whether this is the exact amount. So the president should also request the committee also to verify whether we are actually receiving the accurate data or not.
Mamir says the government of South Sudan should hold accountable individuals that are found guilty of mismanaging the petroleum sector. He says research institutions, including the Soot Institute, are often blocked from accessing information about the oil industry.
We used to complain a lot with Khartoum. The government in southern Sudan used to complain, oh, we are not receiving the accurate figures, we are being cheated. But when we got separated from Sudan, we went silent. Nobody is talking about whether what we are receiving is accurate. But why should we be keeping quiet?
Mamer says a team of researchers from the Soot Institute traveled to Paluch oil area in March and found that the environmental and health concerns affecting the people of the host communities are what he calls tragic.
You have to be a strong person not to feel really emotional about what is happening. The communities feel that they have been abandoned by the government because there are a lot of health issues that are attributed to the oil production. There are a lot of health issues, children being born with deformities. There are a lot of them. We found women who have experienced infertility, who have also experienced frequent miscarriages, men who are not, you know, fertile anymore. And they are attributing all these things to the oil production. They said all these issues never exist in the areas before the oil industry started.
Oil accounts for more than 90% of the government revenues in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Rebels of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition say 1,000 troops assembled at a cantonment site in Amadi State have no food, shelter, and medical care. Major General John Bariano Forule commands the forces in Amadi State. He says the National Pre-Transitional Committee should provide services to prevent SPLA-IO deserting cantonment sites.
But the challenge is actually there is no food. Therefore, it is very hard to keep the people in one place without food at all. So that is the biggest challenge now. And that made the people, the forces to move around looking for food.
One would ask, how were these soldiers feeding themselves before getting into the cantonment site? These areas are all under your control. You are from the area. Why should you be starving?
But previously, it is the community that supplies helping the people, the forces. But now, since the agreement is there, we don't need to go back to the community to ask them to continue to help. What is the program which is now belonging to the government? So we don't need to bother them. We need to follow the agreement.
The people who are working towards implementing the agreement in Juba now composes of the government and SPLM-IO. Have you made this situation known to your leaders who are sitting in Juba in hotels?
Yes. You see, the issue is that it is NPTC that can give the support, give the food for the people, the containment. But up to now, the government was not able to release the money. Although the Khartoum agreement was that allowed the flow of the oil to go so that they can get the money and then help the containment. But up to now, nothing is happening. So the issue is now with the government of South Sudan.
Why would you blame the government of South Sudan when two of you signed the agreement? I mean, you should blame your leaders for not following up.
No, we are not blaming them. But what we were saying that the agreement has not been followed. I don't know why it's not being followed, but our leaders are there, even in Juba. And they were following it day by day, but nothing is happening.
And so how many soldiers are at this cantonment site that you're talking to me about, and where is it exactly in Amadi State? Amadi State is too big.
Yeah, it is too big, but currently Amadi and Meridi is one division. A division is 12,000 soldiers.
So you're talking about 12,000 soldiers who are living in a very bad condition.
We cannot assemble them all in one place because, surely 12,000 in one place without food, it is going to be dangerous. They are ready to come to the containment, but currently it's like 1,000 is assembled 30 miles.
Describe to me exactly how life is at this cantonment site. I mean, what is there? Are there medical facilities? Are there tents? What is there?
there's nothing, there's no medical facility, no food, or what is available there is only water, because there is a river, Yei River Nile, passing through. But all what they were looking for, they support themselves by eating wild food and other things. They support themselves with it. It's just because they want to follow the agreement which was signed that day to the assembly in Kontarne.
What is the way forward with this situation where your soldiers have nothing to eat? How is that going to affect the morale of the soldiers who are assembled there preparing to be integrated into the National Army?
The way forward is actually that we need to make sure that the government, through NPTC, they should work hard to give give the supply to the, particularly in the containment area. Otherwise, it is going to be difficult. It is through NPTC that life will be okay.
The NPTC is made up of all the warring parties, including the SPLM-IO. You're blaming yourself now.
I'm not blaming one side, but it is the, as per agreement actually, that the NPTC is responsible for the containment. And therefore, the NPTC is now formed and they've started their work, but again, they cannot find the soldiers in the containment because there is no food. If there is food, everything will be possible.
That's SPLA-IO Rebel Commander Major General John Bariano Farule speaking with me from the Ugandan capital Kampala earlier today. Conflict in South Sudan has slowed in recent months and tens of thousands of refugees are returning home. Despite the improvements, millions of people across the country continue to go without food. UNICEF reports the level of people facing a critical lack of food in the country is the highest ever. UNMISS Chief David Shearer explains why.
We're getting far less, less incidents that have restricted access. There's certainly been a drop. It's probably two-thirds of what it was a year ago. And the nature of the incidents have diminished in their seriousness. So it's not to say that things are perfect or anything like that, far from it, but there's definitely been an improvement. And in addition to that, there's been an inability to use the Nile River a bit more than there had been, which is also an improvement. The World Food Programme has been able to pre-position food around South Sudan for the rainy season pretty much to the complete needs or the complete requirements that it wanted. And that means that there's been less need for airdrops, which are very expensive. And they're reporting a saving now of about $113 million.
So despite those facts, millions across the country continue to go without food. Just this month, UNICEF said that the number of people facing a critical lack of food in South Sudan is the highest ever. Why do we continue to see, these news headlines about food insecurity in South Sudan, knowing that there has been some progress on the ceasefire front?
Simply because the progress has come throughout the dry season, and so the signing of the peace agreement was done in September when the harvest effectively was in. It was the end of the rainy season. We've had then 6 months of dry season ending effectively at the end of May, beginning of June. People are now planting their crops during this raining season, which is here now, and they'll harvest likely, towards the end of the year. Now, for the first time, we're seeing in some counties an improvement. It's still a very small improvement on the overall circumstances, but with people moving back to their homes and starting to plant, we may now start to see an improvement in the food insecurity situation. It's difficult to say right at the moment because the situation is so critical, but having that rainy season and a degree of calm, we may now see a slight improvement.
Based on UNMISS's statistics, 76,000 South Sudanese are coming back home per month. Where are they coming from and what kind of conditions are they returning to?
About 500,000 people have come back. More than 200,000 of those have come back from neighboring countries. So it's been a mix of those people internally displaced as well as those who are refugees. Look, they come back often to situations in which there are not a lot of services. Often there are very little in the way of schools or health centres. But they are returning to their homes.
That's David Shaira, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for South Sudan and head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan. He was speaking to Ayen Deng Bior from the UN headquarters in New York yesterday. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, USAID makes a contribution to preserve South Sudan's wildlife. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite smell and why?
I love the smell of good food. For me, the smell of food means time to stop and eat and be happy.
My favorite smell is strawberry. Because of the fragrance, it brings ladies to me, it attracts ladies. And ladies like strawberries, so me too, I had to go along with strawberries.
I like mostly hibiscus. There is a sauce called hibiscus, I don't know. So I really feel good when I smell it, and I enjoy it so much.
My favorite smell is the smell of fish. When my mom cook fish, I really enjoy that smell.
Perfume, because it makes one smell nice and makes one confident in his going and coming.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United States Agency for International Development has pledged $7.5 million for a 3-year project to conserve wildlife, natural resources, and protected areas across South Sudan. A USAID official in South Sudan says the project will help build sustainable livelihood and mitigate conflict in and around Buma and Bandingilo National Parks. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
Jeffrey Hill, director of USAID Economic Growth Office in South Sudan, says while the project aims to conserve wildlife, it will also take into account the interests and needs of local communities. Hill says USAID officials have met with community leaders from Boma and Badingilo National Park who express the needs of citizens.
They want education. They want health care. They want water points. They want jobs and incomes. They want to stop fighting, right, as a primary means of getting these things, right? And so that what they want is to actually see the landscape and the wildlife developed and managed in a way that helps them get these things, and so that their interest in is being able to ensure a sustainable management of these natural resources that generates things, economic and social livelihoods.
South Sudan is rich in wildlife and natural resources, but the country's history of conflict puts wildlife population and habitat under increasing pressure from poachers and traffickers making money off of wildlife products, illegal charcoal production, mining, logging, and unregulated development. Hill says the international organization Wildlife Conservation Society will partner with a local organization to implement the project.
There are unique South Sudan organizations that have been identified to work with the local communities. And working with the local communities to build conservation societies, and so that the local communities can actually, both have better land use management within their communities, but also, look at how they can get livelihoods, from this.
South Sudan is rich in natural resources that are important regionally and globally, according to Hill.
The park in the Bandingilo landscape, Boma Bandingilo landscape, is a remarkable, area, really unique in East Africa, unique in Africa, unique in the world. It needs special recognition as a unique landscape that is really, has both the woodlands, it has mountains, it has the different savanna areas, right, and being able to actually be home to the wildlife that is there.
Since violence erupted in South Sudan in 2013, USAID shifted its assistance from state building to more direct assistance to the people of South Sudan by engaging in projects that USAID says build the foundation for a stable and socially cohesive nation by promoting recovery, resilience, and lasting peace at the national and community level. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
The audience at a recent discussion on the future of South Sudan held at the United States Institute of Peace here in Washington asked many questions about the fate of the revitalized peace deal. Here is Susan Stegand, Director for Africa Programs at the Institute, taking questions and answers from panelists and participants at the forum.
We are going to open it up to the audience. Thank you to everybody for the time that you've given, but I hope you'll agree it was worthwhile to dig into some of these issues a little bit deeper. I'm going to ask people to keep their questions or comments short. We'll take a couple at a time, and then we'll turn to our panelists to do responses. I'm going to take first set in this section, so at the very back.
Dane Smith from AFREX. Is it on? I heard a surprising statement. At least it was surprising to me. Civil society in South Sudan is very strong. That seems to go against much of the analysis that was being given about the peace situation. Is that an evolution over the last couple of years? I would be interested in some analysis of how that has occurred, if it has occurred. Also, I'm particularly interested in the role of the churches. Nothing has been said this morning about the churches. We had a major dramatic event in the Vatican not too long ago in which the two leaders were brought together and the Pope actually got down on his knees and kissed their shoes. So I'm interested in hearing some more about the civil society and the role of the churches in this process of peace building, including accountability.
Thanks. We're going to take. Then I lose all prerogative as moderator if I give you my mic.
That's right, to save time. My name is Samuel Akau, and I'm actually very pleased to hear all the different angles that you have brought to the issue. And I just wanted to highlight like some of the two things that I didn't hear so much about that I think are critical to sustainable peace in South Sudan. And the one is that the trust, I think, is the most underlying principle, that if you don't have that, regardless of all the documents, agreements you do, you know, everything will just break down. And we saw that in 2016 because Riek and Kiir didn't have that. And so very dangerously situation was created. And so in this peace agreement that's being signed, we now have the country splintered, all different groups, and I'm not seeing a trust happening. We now have four vice presidents, as you've said, and as we build towards the next election, I foresee a situation where each of them is actually trying to build their loyalty and trying to create an environment where they would be electable, including Kiir himself, trying to do the same. And so if they keep undermining each other and they don't see the peace as a priority, as important for their individual gain, they'll just keep undermining each other and everything will fall down apart. So what is actually being done to make sure that this exists and creates an opportunity for that? And then the other question is on the issue of the private sector. If we saw the conflict in 2013, it seems like it was political, but at the same time, it was resource-driven because we had the oil shutdown in 2012. And the government, the way Kiir has been building the government around at the time, was trying to buy loyalty from people. So we have generals, people being put in the military, and resources being used to actually buy loyalty from people. So when the resources actually began to shrink, there was an opportunity for most people to actually, they lost, you know, and everybody wanted to be around the president and have all that loyalty. So you see a lot of discontent. And so those people who were discontent with the government, they created their own groups, they formed their own groups to actually challenge Kiir. towards the election. And so we saw that in December. That was one of the reasons a lot of people were disgruntled with the government did that. So as this culture has actually been created in South Sudan, where people see government as the only opportunity for making money for wealth. And so what is being done to ensure that we open up the country, we open up the private sector, we create infrastructure so that people who necessarily don't want power can go and do something elsewhere to be self-sufficient?
Thanks for those questions. And then there's... My name is Miriam. I'm from American University. And clearly there's a crisis of governance. I didn't hear people mentioning about federalism. And it's not a new issue in South Sudan, because the current government, which is in Juba, it has failed its responsibilities towards the people, both in the state level and the county level. So I was wondering if federalism is an important aspect of this peace agreement, in the sense that if you can have people be able to benefit within their states, and then to feel like marginalized, and it will sort of also help reduce the tensions happening in Juba, especially according to these tribal issues and fight for resources.
Great. So that's a pretty broad round of questions. I'm going to ask that panelists don't answer every single question, but ones that, where you think you have something particular to add. So maybe we can start with the private sector question. Is that, Mark, is that something you want to jump in on?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I agree with your assessment that the way the private sector has worked at this point, it's become predatory, it's exclusionary. There's a fight for control of the resources, which sparked, in my opinion, a lot of this conflict itself. I'll return to Chapter 4, which it's meant to be there to make for a more accountable economy and one that's trustworthy and that people can feel when they return, IDPs or refugees return, that there's actual a level of governance that allows for them to reinvest into their own country. So it's not just big investors coming in, which unfortunately is a long way off. But it's returning, and on a personal level, I mean, you also talked about trust. It's the trust to go back to your community and to have a line of credit, have banks reopen. You know, all this requires, a fair amount of institution building that won't happen overnight. But it's important now to lay that groundwork.
Maybe to the civil society question and the role of the churches, I'll look to Morgan and then turn to Dr. Emily. If others want to weigh in, that's great.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that there's been an evolution of civil society over recent years, and we've seen them take on a much more active and effective role. In particular, in recent years, I think they've recognized the power of coalitions. A few years ago, the NGO world was very siloed. Everyone was competing for money. They're still competing for money, but they have they're doing a much better job of working together, particularly in issues like advocating for implementation of the peace agreement, where they are more vulnerable when they work alone. And when they work together, they're more effective and they're a little bit less vulnerable. And when they do that, they often work together with the churches. The churches do have sort of a little bit more leeway to speak more openly. And they've definitely taken on a big role in the revitalization process. So I think they're going to continue to be an important actor to work with in order to put pressure on the leaders.
Those panelists, Morgan Simpson, Deputy Director of Democracy International, Mark Forello, Senior Advisor with the Sentry. In the fifth and final part of our discussion tomorrow, we continue to hear from participants who want to know more about the situation in South Sudan. That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with a traditional song from my village, Maridi. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you inviting us into your homes and vehicles. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.